Stay tuned now for Dr. Stephen Zelikoff and a program you will not want to miss. Bone Talk. That's Bone Talk with Dr. Stephen Zelikoff on 1460 WVOX.
Hi. Welcome again to another section of Bone Talk. My name is Dr. Stephen Zelikoff, and today we're going to be talking about hip arthritis and hip pain and little questions that people have about how to get their hips better. I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Yasmin Dar, and we're going to be having a chat and sort of going back and forth and going through some common questions about hip pain. Dr. Dar?
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. And Dr. Dar, of course, is head of sports medicine at Montefiore and Rochelle and team doctors to a lot of local teams, both high school and college teams. This is a busy time for Dr. Dar with all the football going on. How's that been going with that?
Well, football season has got off to a great start. We were shut down, obviously, last year with everything, and our kids and athletes are getting back, which is great.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for being part of Bone Talk. So what I was hoping today to sort of get the opportunity to do is to sort of go through common questions about hip pain, where the hip is in relationship to back pain, and then go through some thoughts about information about hip replacement. A lot of times people present with hip pain, and the first place they tend to go is the Internet on Google, and some of that information is good, and some of it is questionable depending on the site they find. So the hope is to try to give people a little bit of clarity today about dealing with the hip.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you are going to offer us a wealth of information. You've been doing hip and knee replacement and arthritis treatments for many years. And I'm interested to see a lot of your viewpoints on hip arthritis and the options for treatment.
Thank you.
So, I mean, actually, I think we should start out with just what is hip arthritis. I even have my own patients that come in, and it's a word that gets thrown around a lot. And we say, oh, you have arthritis. But I think your average person may not even know what that is. So what exactly is it?
Sure. Well, the hip in general is a ball and socket joint that's made up at the top of your femur or your thigh bone and the sockets in your pelvis. And usually it's located pretty much in the area where your groin is, at the crease where your thigh, where your leg meets your torso or your pelvis. And that's really where your hip is. So then when people talk about, like, my hip hurts, that's usually where the area that we tend to find mostly. A lot of times people look at back pain that's more in the buttock area and the lower back, and they say, like, oh, my hip hurts. That's really tends to be probably more come from the back. What arthritis really is, it's a wearing away of cartilage. When we're born, we have a nice coating of cartilage that makes up the top of our joint surfaces. And that's a very smooth surface that provides a lot of cushioning. What happens in arthritis, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, some of the causes that this can lead to, but what happens in arthritis is that cartilage gets worn away, and then instead of having two smooth surfaces rubbing against each other, you end up with bone on bone. There's less flexibility. There's more stiffness. That leads to more pain. Also, there's not a lot of nerve endings in cartilage, whereas there are nerve endings in bones. So what happens is if we lose that cushioning, what occurs is that you end up with increasing pain. Well, what I try to tell some of my patients with arthritis is that as you lose the cushioning, it's kind of like jumping off of a curb without your sneakers on, and the forces are just going right up into your foot instead of the nice thick cushioning at the bottom of your shoe. And that's really what happens in arthritis, because that force now starts coming directly into the bone, and that tends to give you a lot of the pain and stiffness and discomfort that most people complain about.
Oh, interesting. I use a lot of car analogies, so it's kind of like an unpaved road.
Exactly.
And so what? How does it happen? I mean, can I just get hip arthritis, or does something have to happen for me to get it?
Well, there's several different types of arthritis, first of all. And the most common type of arthritis is osteoarthritis. And that's, you know, the wear and tear type of arthritis that people will experience over time. Usually it happens in people over the age of 60, but we see it in younger patients as well. Some of the reasons that people can develop this thing can really vary from person to person. Part of it has to do with the anatomic structure of the hip. In terms of the shape of the ball, whether the hip was sort of mal-shaped from child from childhood. Weight also has a lot to do with it. People that are more overweight definitely put more stress on their joints. As I mentioned on previous shows, is that there's a 4-to-1 ratio between the weight that you carry and the forces on your leg, so that every 10 pounds you take off, your hip will see 40. So that's a big part of that. Activity level has a lot to do with it. But there's other things that can cause arthritis as well, and those include autoimmune inflammatory diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, people that have lupus. Also, a traumatic hip injury can lead to it, such as a previous hip fracture or a break in the bone. Also, there's something which can also lead to it, which is something called hip impingement or hip dysplasia, which I mentioned before has a little to do with the shape of your ball and of the hip, but you tend to see a lot more of that in your sports medicine patients.
Right, we do. We see, hip impingement, it can happen obviously in older people too, but in our younger population, it's a lot of flexed activities like hockey players or jumpers, and they get a little extra bit of bone on the edge of their the ball part, and it kind of rubs and pinches, and it hurts. I think if you look at those patients down the line, years later, it could wear along the cartilage of the hip and ball and socket. So sometimes if you get to them early, if they have the symptoms early, there's other options for treatment depending on, and we'll get into the treatment depending on what age they are and how the rest of the hip looks. Once the process starts, is it a slippery slope? Is it always going to progress?
I mean, I think it varies. I think that arthritis is sort of tends to be progressive, so that it very rarely regresses. I mean, some of the symptoms can get better. And usually what happens is that there's two groups of patients that I tend to see in the office. One that sort of comes in, says, I've had symptoms for like several years now. I'm getting worse. I can't function. I can't do the things I enjoy doing. And we'll talk a little about some of those symptoms in a little bit. And then there's the people that have an acute episodes where they kind of fell off of something, or they sort of had an injury, and then all of a sudden they have what we call an acute on chronic episode,
like
where they may have had a little bit of arthritis, but they had an acute injury. And that acute injury is now what's giving them some of the symptoms that they're having. And those patients actually can do better with sort of an injection, or they can do better with some physical therapy, anti-inflammatories. And hopefully we can get them back to their baseline, which is usually pretty functional. So I think that overall, that's why you got to take a look and listen to the story that patients come in with, or the people come in with, in terms of whether this is a long-standing problem that's just getting progressively worse, or it's something that's more acute. But in general, arthritis tends not to sort of get better over time. It may stabilize, and people can sort of putter along for long periods of time, but it rarely gets better because you can't grow that cartilage back, and I think that's the biggest problem. It's a degenerative process, and I think
that
tends to be it just progresses, yes.
But no one can tell you how quickly or how long it's going to take for someone to get worse. I guess it varies, like you're saying, weight, activity, all these different variables. So your average person who you see, what are their biggest complaints? What symptoms do they have what symptoms would I have if I started to be concerned that maybe I have hip arthritis? What would I feel?
Mostly it tends to be sort of stiffness. You may find that you have some stiffness in your groin and in your hip, and certain activities, because again, the hip is sort of a ball and socket, and the activities that are most commonly related to the hip tend to be things that involve flexion and rotation of your hip, which means things like putting on your shoes and socks, cutting your toenails, getting out of a car, things that involve crossing your legs. So those are the things that tend to most likely involve your hip. And those are the symptoms that, if you're finding that that's becoming more and more difficult, then that may be something that may lead you to say, like, oh, maybe I have a bad hip. Also, limping. I think that, you may find that all of a sudden your family kind of looks at you and says, like, why are you limping? And, that may be coming from your hip, although there's lots of reasons that people can limp. It can also be coming from a back, another area, or a knee. But certainly a hip is a common source of that. But most of the things that people tend to complain about with hip symptoms tend to be aching pain in the groin region, outer thigh and buttocks, joint stiffness, and reduced range of motion. And those are the things that tend to be the most limiting. Also, commonly, patients with hip pain can sometimes have pain radiating down to their knee. So if they tend to have some knee symptoms, that sometimes can also come from the hip.
Do people always get it on both sides, or can it just be one side?
It could be one side. It could be both sides. Most commonly, we tend to see it on one side. But I've had patients that have presented with arthritis of both of their hips, so it's not uncommon because there's also a genetic predisposition as well. Some people just are born with cartilage that's more fragile and doesn't wear as well, and they tend to have a higher predisposition to having arthritis in other joints as well. So they may have bad hips as well as bad knees as well and other problems with other joints as well. So it's not uncommon, but it doesn't have to be. So if you have one bad hip, it doesn't mean that the other one's going to go as well.
So for you, those of you just joining us now, I'm Dr. Yasmin Dar, and we're speaking with our standard host, Dr. Stephen Zelikoff, who is giving us insights on hip arthritis and treatments for hip arthritis, such as joint replacement. A lot of experience, and like I said, interested to know. Dr. Zelikoff is the chief of the joint replacement service at Westchester Medical Center, as well as the chief of orthopedic surgery at Montefiore New Rochelle, and has a significant training. Training at Hospital for Special Surgery, training at Harvard, doing joint replacements. So let's see, what happens when you see a patient, they come in, and what can someone expect when they go to their doctor, their orthopedic surgeon, when they see you? What can they expect from that visit?
So my biggest thing is that what I like to do whenever I see a patient for the first time, it's mostly to understand what their goals are and what their problem is. So we usually ask them, like, well, what are you here for? I mean, you know, is it mostly because of pain in your hip? And then the question is, in a history, the biggest thing is that you want to make sure that you tell your surgeon is, number one, was this something that's been chronic, or is it something that you just really started with? Was there any kind of injury? What kind of treatments have you had for it in the past? Have you used anti-inflammatories? Have you had physical therapy? Have you used any type of assistive devices? And then once we've determined in terms of what, you know, the patient's been having in the past, again, the type of pain, how do they rate the pain, how do they qualify, is it sharp, is it dull, is it achy, and are there other joints involved as well? Do they have problems in the other parts of their body? Usually we like to get a great history, finding out their medical history in terms of, like, do they have any history of other medical problems as well, such as injuries with their heart and things of that nature. A good physical examination is part of what I tend to do with my patients, is that we take a look, watch you walk, we take a look and examine your hip as well as other parts of the body as well. And then ultimately we may get an x-ray or imaging studies.
This is always a big question that comes up. You know, people, can you see things on an x-ray, or do I need an MRI?
Oh, absolutely. I think that they both serve very, very different things. I think that the x-ray serves the purpose to give us a much better view of the bones and the bony anatomy. MRIs tend to be very, very good at looking at soft tissue and other type of pathology, so that I think they work together. I think that they both provide very, very different sources of information. Also, most of our x-rays are standing or loaded, whereas MRIs usually aren't. So that tells us that there's more narrowing of the joint as forces are being placed across the joint. So that those are all things that we tend to do. So I usually will get an x-ray because I find it provides a lot of good information. If you've had x-rays from other facilities, you know, bring them in, because it's always nice to be able to see comparative films, also to see how things have progressed as well. But then when I've sort of gotten a sense as to, you know, what's going on, I think the biggest thing is to really identify what the patient's goal is. I mean, what are they looking for? Is it just pain relief? Is it sort of, what are the kind of activities that they want to go back to? What kind of things do they enjoy doing? Is it mostly they want to go back to sports? Are they primarily just happy just going for a walk? Or are they high-performance athletes that are triathletes that want to go back to running, biking, hiking, things of that nature? So I think finding out what people's goals are in terms of what their activity level is and what they've lost so far because of their current pain situation, and then what we need to do to try to get them to that level, I think is probably one of the biggest parts and the biggest conversation I tend to have with my patients, is to find out what their goals are, what their preconceived notions are about what, you know, hip treatments are and things of that nature, because a lot of times people come in and they're terrified that they may need surgery, and I just like to ask them, well, what are you scared of? because we can usually allay a lot of those concerns just by giving them just sort of like reality, because a lot of times they hear something on, you know, on the internet, or they may have had like a friend or an acquaintance who had a bad result of some sort. And most people tend to do well, and the people that do well talk about their golf game and their grandkids, and the people that don't tend to hover about one particular issue. So I think it's very, very important to give people a real sense of what their options are.
I think that's great. I mean, you know, that sense of individualized care. I mean, one of the symptoms you were describing, which is loss of motion, obviously that would be different for someone who's walking versus someone who is, you know, a triathlete who has to cycle and flex their hip. So those two patients, you're right, would maybe have two different treatment options for them. So not everybody needs surgery, right? There are some options for people before they have surgery?
Absolutely. I think that, first of all, it's important to figure out, again, if this is a chronic issue or an acute issue. But the things I tend to recommend mostly are activity modifications. So reducing or stopping activities that cause the pain. So it's sort of that old joke, you know, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't do that. So I think that that's something which, you know, clearly is certainly helpful, although it's hard to tell people to stop walking. You know, if walking is the thing that hurts, then, you know, telling you to stop walking isn't helpful. Weight loss can definitely help. I do like to recommend physical therapy, because I think that the stronger we keep your muscles around your joint and the more flexible you are, I think that definitely makes a big difference, either whether that's the beginning of a process of having surgery. We do that as part of our prehab or pre-rehabilitation process. But a lot of times a little bit of physical therapy and some weight loss can help. I think using a cane can definitely make a big difference. I tend to recommend using a cane in the opposite hand, because that takes a lot of pressure off of the hip. And then anti-inflammatories can help. Certainly things like ibuprofen, Advil, Aleve, Celebrex, like a COX-2 inhibitor can help. But the one thing which you got to keep in mind is that, you know, people say like, oh, I'm taking anti-inflammatory, so that's conservative medicine or conservative care or non-surgical care. But the fact is that those things have high risks as well. They raise your blood pressure. They can give you stomach ulcers. They can give you bleeds. So I think that, you know, I'm a big fan of medications for short periods of time. But I think once you've taken something for like 2-3 weeks and it's not better, then I think, you know, the concept of doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, is usually the sign of insanity. It's like, I think Einstein said that. But I think that it's something where if it gets better, great. If it doesn't, then you got to look into other options to fix it.
Right. I mean, I come in, I don't want to take these medications, I can't tie my shoe, I can't ride my bike. You know, at this point, your next option is going to be surgery. So most of those surgeries are hip replacements. You're replacing everything, the ball and the socket. How do the surgeries work?
So most opportunities for surgeries for advanced arthritis tend to be hip replacement. I mean, there's two types of common hip replacements. I think one was something that we did historically, which we're not doing as much anymore, is hip resurfacing, where we put a metal cap on top of the ball of the hip, and then a socket, a metal socket inside the pelvis. And then the more common thing that we're doing at this point is something called total hip replacement, where we're replacing both the ball as well as the socket.
What do you replace it with?
The implants are made out of metals. They're made usually titanium implants, and they have a ceramic ball that makes up for the ball of your hip. And then the socket is a titanium shell and has a plastic liner on the inside that makes up for the cartilage. So instead of walking bone on bone, you're now walking ceramic on plastic.
So now you got a bionic hip.
You're bionic. You're not only that, but you're totally hip.
So is this a big surgery? Do I need to go into the hospital? Am I walking around the next day? How do I recover from this surgery?
Sure. So I think part of the process is that, first of all, before you get into an operation, we make sure that you're as healthy as possible. We'd like you to really optimize your health before the surgery, so that we have to make sure that everything is as good as it possibly can be. And that involves a little bit of physical therapy. Usually we have you see your medical doctor, your internist, your heart doctor as need be. And then if you smoke beforehand, we have you stop smoking. We have you try to lose a little bit of weight. And then also nutritionally, I want to make sure that your diet's good, so that this way you eat a lot of protein, so that when it comes time to surgery, that you're great. If you're diabetic, we want to make sure that your blood sugar is under good control, so you don't run the risk of higher risk of infection and things of that nature.
So you really want to tee people up for this surgery.
We want to make sure
everything
that you're
great, so they can
absolutely
fly through it.
I want to minimize any possible chance of problems. So I think the better off you are coming into this procedure, the better off you're going to do. You know, as far as surgery goes, you know, whether it's a big operation, I'm a big believer in that there's no such thing as a small operation when it's on you. But having said that, what we try to do is to make sure that the experience is as positive as possible. So we have a wonderful team where basically the institutions that I work at, out of both at Montefiore and New Rochelle, as well as Westchester Medical Center and down in the city at the Hospital for Special Surgery, we have programs in place to make sure that we really cater to the joint replacement patient, to make sure that their experience is really as comfortable as possible. We have pre-op classes we have them work with, and we have a team of specialists within the hospital, both in terms of physical therapist, pain management specialist, as well as nursing staff, whose job really is to make sure that the experience is terrific. The surgery, for the most part, usually tends to be done under a regional anesthetic, which means that you're sleepy, you're comfortable, you don't have to hear anything or know anything, but oftentimes it's not general anesthesia, which is safer. The procedure, we make a small incision along the hip and then split the muscles and then essentially go in, take out the bone that's worn out and put a new hip inside. Most of the time, the implant's put in without the use of bone cement, so this way the bone actually grows up to the implant. I try to, when I close up my incisions, we don't use staples for the skin. We use a glue to close up the incision, so this way there's no stitches or staples that have to come out. And we use a dressing that people can shower with right away. We get people up the same day. They're walking the same day. They're able to do stairs the same day. We've now started doing outpatient hip replacements so that for the right patient who's a candidate, they can actually go home the same day. If they're healthy and active and have a good support staff at home with them, if people need extra help, we keep them in the hospital. They enjoy our hospitality for a few days. The care is terrific. The food, not so much. But for the most part, people do really well. And by the time they leave the hospital, they're able to walk and move pretty readily. Usually
so they can
people
walk
go
around,
home. Yeah,
they
were usually most people go home on a cane.
And then can I get back to people, some of my normal activities?
Well, we let you drive usually in about 2 weeks. Back to most things about 4 to 6 weeks, people are back about 85 to 90%, and hips take about 6 months to a year until they're really part of you. But usually for the most part, I let people go back to things like tennis and things of that nature, usually at about 2 or 3 months. You know, I think the biggest thing that people are concerned about is that can I ever get back to my hiking and biking and doing all those things. And usually, mostly, I tell people to go back to the things that they enjoy doing. The only thing I try to tell them not to do is things which are repetitive long-distance running. So that if you're a marathon runner, I'd probably prefer that you not do that. But if you want to play a little softball, if you want to do a little light jogging, I think that, or you're a skier and you're a good skier, then I'd probably tell you not to do bumps maybe, or to avoid that last run of the day when it's the lights off. But for the most part, go back to doing the things that you want to do, and the whole purpose of doing this is so you can get your life back.
Right. So, I mean, those long-distance runners, they put a lot of wear and tear across the, you know, their native hip and then a hip replacement. I guess the concern people a lot of times have is how long do these hip replacements last?
So I think more the newer bearings now, the wear on them really tend to last 35, 40 years, maybe longer. So the wear rates are about 1% per year for need for redos. So that's about, you got a 50-50 chance it'll last you 50 years. And again, that varies from person to person, and there's variations with that. But for the most part, I mean, the implants, particularly the newer ones that are now we're using for people, have really become lifetime implants, which is really exciting.
Wow, that's a lifetime's a long time. so you've been doing this a long time. I mean, you've
yes.
probably done. I probably can't even count how many hip replacements. So I think you're a good person to ask. How do you pick a surgeon? How do you know who to go to?
You know, I think that part of it is a reputation. I think part of it is meeting different surgeons. It's always good to sort of see different people. And then it's looking for chemistry and finding somebody that you're comfortable with and find somebody who you can talk to, because the relationship that you're going to have with your surgeon should be a long-term relationship. So it's find somebody that you're comfortable with, that you feel comfortable with, and again, somebody that really does this a lot, because it's kind of like anything that you tend to do. The more you do it, the better off you are at it. So that, you know, there's people that tend to do all kinds of different parts of orthopedics. In our group, which is specialty orthopedics, we're subspecialized. So I don't do ACL reconstructions. I don't do shoulder procedures. I leave that up to you because you're really good at it. So all I do is hip and knee replacement surgery. And so it's something where find somebody who you're comfortable with, find somebody who feels that they do this a lot, and ask questions. And I think that that's probably the best way to sort of pick a surgeon at this point.
Great. I mean, I know I would pick you because I've seen your work, and it's your patients are happy, and they get back to their life, which is the reason to do it. Just a quick question on approaches. You know, you hear a lot of things about anterior approach, posterior approach. I mean, which one's the best one to do? I mean, what do you want your surgeon to do?
I think I would have the surgeon do whatever they're most comfortable with. I think that they all work, and they all work well, and there's no data after a period of about 4 to 6 weeks that there's any difference. So I think it's finding a procedure that your surgeon is the most comfortable with and letting them do that procedure. I've done both procedures. I think they both work well, and I tend to individualize the procedure to the patient. And I think I try to individualize the operation that I tend to do to every different patient so that while we do the same general procedure, overall we try to make sure that it's really specially made for that patient and their needs. So I think that that's the way that I sort of approach surgical procedures, certainly around the hip and the knee. So
great.
I think we're sort of coming down on time.
Yeah, wonderful amount of information and letting people know that there are options without surgery and, you know, surgery when they end up needing it, they have great results.
Well, listen, thank you so much, and thank you again, everybody, for tuning in to Bone Talk. Again, thank you again to Dr. Yasmin Dar. I'm Dr. Steven Zelikoff. And again, wrapping up another session of Bone Talk.